Dr. John F. Duffy, the Armistead and Dolby Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. He may be known to many of you. He has been ranked one of the 25 most influential persons in intellectual property and the 50 most influential IP experts in the world. His credentials are legion. I had the pleasure of watching him argue an en banc case several years ago. I thought he was fantastic. And he's better known for his other writings. He's an author of a leading casebook on patent law, as well as he has excellent credentials in the legal community, having worked for Judge Stephen Williams and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. With that, I will turn it over to Professor Duffy for his remarks. Class is in session.
But there won't be a quiz afterwards, so don't really worry. I don't know if my slide deck is going to be up
we'll
here.
Check on that. We'll check that.
If not, I can plug into the video right here with my computer. Anyway, the new patent bill, which is still pending legislation, and I hope doesn't become law, but I fear may, I think it's going to lead to fairly fundamental changes in our patent system. It's going to make our patent system quite a bit more bureaucratic and really shift the focus from the courts, I think, in significant ways, to the bureaucracy, which I think is a quite radical change historically in terms of what we normally have done. Normally in the patent system, most things are resolved in the courts. Many of the policy disputes are resolved in the courts. The agency has historically had less power than most modern, meaning 20th century administrative agencies. The basic structure of this agency was created in the 19th century, the early 19th century, in the age of Jackson. And this bill is going to create, this is really a continuation of a process. In the last 20 years or so, we've created more and more administrative proceedings, which tend to shift focus away from the courts and towards the administrative agency. One of the things I don't like about this bill is that it creates even more proceedings without getting rid of any. It's a little bit difficult in terms of figuring out the... Actually, why don't I just plug in my computer so I can run my slide deck? Is that a thing? I think we can do that. If you create these slides, I think it's sort of helpful to actually walk through the provisions of the bill, especially the ones I find troubling. Okay. All right, so the basic thesis is that it's going to make this the patent system more expensive, and I think I can prove that, more lawyerly, and I'm going to explain that a little bit, and more complex. And that's, I think, a significant change. And that I find surprising as a scholar. This is a time when, inside Washington, we're looking for ways to make governmental processes less expensive and less complex. If you talk to political leaders, they'd say, we want things to be cheaper, government to be simpler, and government to be less complex. And this bill quite clearly adds significant new levels of red tape, significant new levels of bureaucratic process. And that's not opinion. That's if you look at the bill, there are numerous new provisions. Indeed, the PTO people who are here are going to have to engage in numerous rulemakings. They even have a list currently up on the web of all the rulemakings that they're going to have to do. Well, that means more and more and more regulations that will fill the Federal Register. That's not imagination. That's what will happen. The PTO, if you ask them, will tell you that. So let's go to, and as a scholar, I'm philosophically, I don't like this. But, as a scholar, I also find it interesting. Even a car accident, I teach sports too, even a car accident is interesting to a professor. Or a train wreck. Now the first thing to start out to sort of think that this bill is going to add to complexity is its length. This is a long piece of legislation. The entire Patent Act of 1952, which served the country pretty well for a long period of time, was 24 pages. This thing's 150. Now, I know that people are going to say, it's double space. And it's a little bit, more generous margin. You're right, but I actually did a calculation based on word counts. And you know, the 1952 Patent Act could comfortably fit within 66 pages of the same type of print. So this thing is, you know, more than twice the length, and it's just an amendment. All the rest of the 1952 Patent Act stays, and nothing, plus there's been some more recent amendments. So this thing is long. You might think, well, it's long because patents are important. That's wrong. Okay? Look at, there's lots of other patents. First of all, earlier patent acts, 1870 Patent Act, 20 pages, that had some trademark stuff in it too. Patent Act of 1836, which was really quite a revolutionary statute. It was the first statute in the world that established an examination process. Anywhere in the world, it was quite revolutionary for its day. 9 pages long. Civil Rights Act of 1963, kind of important statute. That covered not just public accommodations, it covered voting rights, it covered all kinds of important things. 28 pages. Again, even if you expand it out, you don't have to have length in order to have important legislation that is meaningful to society. And what do you get when you get a long bill? Well, you get complexity. And there's another, before we get to complexity, I just want to talk about the costs. There's an immediate 15% bump up in all your fees, okay? And that's just until the PTO gets around to raising your fees more. So this is gonna be expensive. And when I show you the complexity, you're going to say, how is that, why should I care? Well, you're going to be paying for it if you're an inventor. Now, if you're a patent attorney, you might think, oh, this is good. You know, it's like more patents, more procedure, you know, more jobs at the PTO. So maybe you're the winning, you're the winner. Maybe you're part of the winning class in this, although if you make the patent system very expensive, then I think at some point the system might collapse and you might have fewer patent applications. And, you know, probably the worst thing about this all is which people have talked about. I think maybe Judge, I'm sorry I wasn't here for Judge Michelle's talk, but I think Judge Michelle probably pointed this out, is that you can increase the fees and Congress can keep the money for other things. So if you're thinking, well, at least I'll get a better, faster process when the fees goes up, think again. So that's a problem, I think. I think the fees that are increased, especially the maintenance fees, those are patents that already exist. It is impossible to consider that as anything more than a property tax. It's a tax on property, an increase of tax on property. Now, you might think tax increases are a good thing or a bad thing, but you should talk about what it is. It's not a fee for getting new services. If you've already got your patent through whatever slow processes the PTO previously provided, you're not going to be helped by the new fees. You're just going to be paying a maintenance fee. And that's where the agency gets a lot of its revenues, because the maintenance fee is a fee that it has to charge people and it has to provide no service. All it has to do is not cancel your patent. So that's pretty easy to do for an agency. So that's a property tax, which one would think some of the groups that are against tax increases and some of the political entities that are against tax increases should rethink that particular aspect of it. So here's what you're paying for when you get increased procedures. These are the procedures that we previously had. Now, in fact, only the first three existed up until 1980. In other words, for more than 100 years, we survived with three fairly simple basic procedures at the agency level. We had examination, we had interferences, which was just sort of another species of examination when people were both seeking the same rights, the rights to the same invention. And reissue and correction. Ex parte reexamination and ex parte examination was added in the early 80s. Congress didn't think that was a good idea, and they figured out that wasn't all that successful. In fact, the legislative history of the 1999 act that added inter partes reexamination said it was a failure. So of course, you know, if you have something and you fail, well, you don't repeal it. You just add another procedure. And now one of the things that happens is you get conflicts between ex parte reexamination and inter partes reexamination and the litigation that's going on in the court. These administrative procedures don't cut off the litigation process at all. So there's always a question over race to who's going to get which process, the administrative process or the judicial process, will finish first. To that, we're adding all these new proceedings. And these new proceedings are going to run in parallel for all the others for a significant number of years because of a phase-in period. And even after they're done, there's going to be a number of other, most of these proceedings are going to survive. I just don't understand. I understand the argument as to why you need some sort of post-grant process. I don't understand why we need 3 or 4 different post-grant processes. And if you need convincing that there's some degree of complexity here, you might say, well, gee, aren't these bureaucratic proceedings? Are they sort of in nice, neat boxes, and some apply sometimes, and others apply other times? Absolutely not. You know that because the statute itself has a section that has to deal with what happens when you're going to have multiple proceedings dealing with the same patent. It not only has one, it has 2 for good measure, which just for complexity's sake aren't identical. So what did the Congress do? Well, it said, you know, the director, punt it all over to the director. When you've got all these different kinds of proceedings that are applying to the same patent, just have the director figure out something to do. So I think that's sort of a marker, right? If you see this in a statute and you say, gee, is there excessive complexity here? You might view this and its companion, its sister piece, which is, again, similar but not identical. You might begin to think that's an indication, a barometer of excessive complexity that, again, you're going to pay for. So the other major change here is that it changes the first to invent system to the first to file system. I think there's an intellectual battle. There's sort of a nice intellectual battle about which is better, first to invent and first to file. One thing to worry about is in a piece where we're already expanding complexity, this is going to be another layer of complexity. Even if it's a good idea to switch from first to invent to first to file, and I'm not terribly convinced about that, although I think the case is there's clearly an intellectual case. You have to remember that while we're doing that, we're going to have to run both systems in parallel for 2 more decades. Why 2 more decades? Because the patents that are being filed today, up and through the enactment of this bill, are all going to get first to invent status. The agency's going to have to continue to deal with those applications for years, you know, maybe into a decade. The courts will continue to have to deal with them for 2 decades, because that's their lifespan, 2 decades plus any additional time they may have gotten through patent additions for delays in the patent office. So the case for this is it makes things administratively easier. I think there is, to be fair, there's a case there. It does make the entire patent system more lawyerly in the sense that lawyers take center stage. It was only a century ago, that the leading commentator on patent law could say unequivocally that in order to invent, you had to actually build something and do something in the real world. In other words, what we all know, what patent lawyers know today is constructive reduction to practice was not lawful. Now, that changed right about that time, about a century ago. And constructive reduction to practice, in other words, just writing out a piece of paper, that became as good as inventing something for real in your workshop and actually putting a product on the market. Today, if this statute is enacted, lawyers take the front seat. You need a lawyer to invent. You need a lawyer to get your priority date. If you're just an inventor, look out. You need help. Or you need an echo. I think that's an intellectual change, and I don't think it's a positive one. See, you know, complexity is hard. You know, you've got all this gear back there, and we're going to have more gear in the patent office. Here's another example. I sort of love this one. There was a debate about whether to eliminate what's called the best mode requirement. I think, again, there's a case for and against eliminating best mode. But what does this bill do? It does neither. You know, it sort of is on the fence. It isn't a requirement anymore, it is a requirement anymore. You don't know, and I'll show you why you don't know. It does say that you still must disclose the best mode requirement in your application. That's still a requirement of law. And I've only got a few more slides, so I think I'm doing all right. But it does eliminate the ability of infringement defendants to raise best mode problems as a defense. Now, this is really a radical change, theoretically, because it's the first time where we've decoupled the legal requirements of validity. In other words, things that the Patent Office says you must do. We're decoupling them from the things that the defendants can raise as a defense to invalidity. It's traditionally been true that if you could say, no, this patent should never have been granted because it didn't qualify, the applicant did not satisfy the requirements of Section 112, the basic disclosure requirements, or it wasn't new, wasn't non-obvious, you could raise all those. And this is going to be the first time we're going to break that symmetry. You might think, well, why do this? It's kind of, you know, it's not eliminated, but it's practically eliminated. So maybe the people who wanted it eliminated have won. Not really, because it's just more complexity. Because it doesn't eliminate the ability of defendants to raise best modes problems as what's known as inequitable conduct. In other words, you can say, well, they should have disclosed this. They should have disclosed the best mode. And because they didn't disclose the best mode, that was fraud on the Patent Office. And that can be used to invalidate. To not invalidate, actually. You've got to be careful. Complexity is maddening. Hold unenforceable your patent, which means practically for you people who might care about money and business, it's the same thing. For you lawyers, it's, of course, two radically different things based on completely different theories. Okay, so what else do we have here? Oh, special interests. Yes, if you're going to have complexity and you're going to have 150 pages, you're going to have special interests. And that means, of course, the one that's the poster child for special interests, and I just picked out two here, the transitional post-grant review proceeding for certain selected business methods, which even the New York Times says, look, this is a special interest deal for banks. That's a payoff or, you know, sort of a thing that's been shoved into this legislation by a single senator, which is Senator Schumer. Again, I'm sort of surprised that the House majority, which a Republican majority, would say, gee, what we really want to do is help Senator Schumer with his special deals. But that's what's in the bill. And another one, here's another one. Here's the real McCoy. Elijah McCoy, a very famous inventor of railroad technology, he's going to get an office, a patent office named after him, even though it's, you know, it's just pure pork. Why Michigan? He's going to get one centered in Detroit. Well, Michigan is a swing state, right? Is there any really compelling reason to put an office in Michigan as opposed to, let's say, Silicon Valley? It seems like that's not. I know the Patent Office did, of course, a completely independent study that demonstrated that, you know, Detroit was the best place. I will note, however, that when they were going to implement a Detroit satellite office themselves, but they put the hold on those plans as a cost cutting measure. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, but they'll be able to go ahead now because, of course, they've got an open path. Because they can raise fees as much as they want to do the things that they want, whether or not that's going to make the patent system better. So, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what things you might have to pay for. So you'll get that. And actually, the patent legislation, again, in sort of great doublespeak, you know, Orwellian doublespeak, says in the earlier section, Section 23, says that there shall be three new satellite offices, but we, the Congress, will not tell the agency where they should be located. We do not want to do that. And then the very next section says the Patent Office in Detroit shall be named the McCoy Patent Office, which, you know, I think if you were the agency, you were the director of the agency, and you were somewhat politically sensitive, and you're trying to read this statute, you'd say, I think I know what they're trying to tell me, where one of those three belongs. So it's going to be in Detroit. And it will be costly. Then finally, you might say, you know, what else is in the 150 pages? This was, I guess, put in late in the provision. It's in its own section. This is the entirety of the section. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's just aspiration. I mean, does this really, I guess there's nothing really objectionable about this, but is it, you know, why waste
the United States statutes at large with, you know, a sense of Congress.
Well, everybody can say, I guess who voted for this can say, well, we, you know, we want to help small businesses and we want to help inventors. Great. You know, but it does, this does nothing. That's the entire section. I don't, you know, I would, everybody could agree with that. They could put a sense of Congress, like, you know, we want to be American and have apple pie, too.